This week on Vaticano, we celebrate the 60-year anniversary of the election of Pope Paul VI. Sit down with Bishop Andrew Cousins to discuss the upcoming National Eucharistic Congress in the United States and witness the power of music to bring people together as we listen to a concert at the Papal Basilica of St. Paul Outside the Walls, hosted by the Israeli Embassy to the Holy See. Vaticano starts now. On Friday, June the 23rd, Pope Francis received 200 artists in the Sistine Chapel. Among them were painters, sculptors, architects, poets, musicians, directors, and actors from 30 different nations. It was an encounter promoted on the occasion of the 50th anniversary of the inauguration of the Vatican Museum's collection of modern art.
You are sharers in God's dream. You are eyes that see, eyes that dream. It is not enough simply to see. We also need to be able to dream.
The audience continued a tradition begun in 1964 when St. Paul VI asked to renew the friendship between the church and artists. It's a friendship Pope Francis wanted to emphasize in his speech.
The church has always had a relationship with artists that can be described as both natural and special. The church's friendship with the arts is thus something quite natural. Yet at the same time, it is also a special friendship, especially if we think of the many periods of history that we have traveled together and which are part of the patrimony of everyone, whether believers or non-believers. Mindful of this, let us look forward to a new season of rich fruits in our own time, born of a climate of listening, freedom, and respect. People need those fruits, those special fruits.
The fruit is special.
Pope Francis closed the encounter with an appeal to the artists, asking them not to forget about those who suffer and those most in need.
Before taking leave of you, I have one more thing to say to you, something close to my heart. I would like to ask you not to forget the poor, those especially close to the heart of Christ, those affected by all of today's many forms of poverty. The poor, too, have need of art and beauty.
E della bellezza.
A tireless seeker of truth. With these words, Pope Francis summarized the figure of Blaise Pascal in his apostolic letter Sublimitas et Miseria Hominis, The Grandeur and Misery of Man, published on June the 19th on the occasion of 400 years since the birth of the 17th century French mathematician, physicist, philosopher, and theologian. Besides his innumerable contributions in the field of the sciences, Blaise Pascal was a man in constant pursuit of truth, restless, and attracted to new and ulterior horizons.
Il 23 novembre 1654.
On November 23rd, 1654, Blaise Pascal experienced a mystical episode known as the Night of Fire, of which we have a historical, personal testimony in a letter called Memorial that was found after his death, sewn into the inside of his coat. It transformed his life and pushed him to dedicate himself with renewed vigor to prayer, making his Christian faith the absolute center of his existence.
For the occasion, the Vatican Apostolic Library also paid homage to Pascal with an exhibition, exclusively for journalists, of some of his works. A copy of the first edition of Thoughts from 1670, a copy of the first edition of his provincial letters, accompanied by a successive edition of the same work in Latin, and lastly, a portrait in the form of an incision dating back to the beginning of the 18th century.
Before the Night of Fire, Pascal already believed in God, but that night he had the illumination of recognizing in sin the symbol of the lack of God's will. From that mystical experience sprang forth his concepts of pride and humility, and especially of the category of the heart, which was very dear to him.
What Pope Francis wished to celebrate with the apostolic letter Sublimitas et Miseria Hominis is the inarguable contribution of Blaise Pascal, a man who still today is able to be admired by believers and non-believers alike.
Hello and welcome to this week's Vaticano Updates, the most important news from Pope Francis and the Vatican. The Holy Father signs a decree recognizing the heroic virtue of Sister Lucia dos Santos. Lucia is the eldest of the three children who witnessed the Fatima apparitions. The Church will now need to approve a miracle attributed to her intercession before she can be beatified. Vatican City's chief prosecutor, who is investigating the 40-year-old case of the missing teenage girl, Emanuela Orlandi, has shared information deemed worthy of further investigation with Rome prosecutors. The Vatican prosecutor said that his office has collected all the evidence available after Pope Francis gave him maximum freedom of action to investigate Orlandi's case on a broad scale without conditions of any kind. Orlandi's disappearance on June 22, 1983, after leaving for a music lesson in Rome, has dominated headlines and been the subject of speculation for decades. On World Refuge Day, June 20th, Pope Francis urged continued prayer and action. In a tweet, Francis said he was thinking of Christ present in so many desperate people fleeing conflicts and climate change. He added, "The problem of hospitality needs to be confronted together." Pope Francis appointed Bishop Christopher Cohn as Coadjutor Archbishop of Hartford. As Coadjutor, Cohn will assist Archbishop Leonard Blair in the administration of the Hartford Archdiocese and should succeed him as Archbishop upon his retirement, expected once Blair turns 75 next year. The 65-year-old bishop previously served as the Auxiliary Bishop of Indianapolis from 2011 until 2015. Pope Francis said he is ready to go and poor health will not keep him away from World Youth Day this August. In a video addressed to young people, the Holy Father said, "Some people think that I can't go because of illness, but the doctor told me I can, so I will be with you." Thank you for watching this week's Vaticano Updates. I'm Matthew Santucci for EW10 Vaticano.
In a few moments, we'll be back with more on Vaticano. It's been exactly 60 years since the election of St. Pope Paul VI. On June the 21st, 1963, Montini ascended to the pontificate. He was known for his gentle and reserved demeanor, accompanied by profound erudition and a strong connection to his spiritual life. In his tenure, he skillfully carried forward the progressive path set by John the 23rd, ensuring the fruitful progress of the Second Vatican Council. Pope Paul VI was born Giovanni Battista Montini, the second of three children, here in the small city of Concesio. His father, Giorgio Montini, was a lawyer, member of the Italian Chamber of Deputies, and political editor of the Catholic paper Il Cittadino di Brescia. His mother, Giuditta Alghisi, was a member of the local noble families and president of the Brescia chapter of Women's Catholic Action. Giovanni Battista grew up in the faith, and both parents, his mother especially, imbued the children with a love of literature, art, music, philosophy, and political life. Fausto Montini is the son of Ludovico Montini, the elder brother of Giovanni Battista. Fausto says that the two brothers were very close, and that his uncle Giovanni Battista was a frequent guest at their house.
My uncle had a very subtle capacity for irony. He was always ready to pick up on the funniest things, always cheerfully and politely, with what you could define as an English sense of humor. He didn't like expensive cassocks, and he would often say at home, when speaking of homilies, that a 5-minute one was for the soul, a 10-minute one was for the preacher, and that a homily lasting a quarter of an hour was for the devil. That's the kind of person he was.
Giovanni Battista Montini was ordained a priest on May the 29th, 1920. After further studies in Rome, he began working in the Holy See Secretariat of State and eventually became a trusted assistant to Cardinal Eugenio Pacelli, the future Pope Pius XII. During the terrible years of World War II, Monsignor Montini helped lead refugee and relief efforts, as well as helping save Jews from death in the gas chambers. In November of 1954, Montini was appointed as Archbishop of Milan and named a cardinal in 1958 by Pope John XXIII. During the conclave in 1963, he was elected Roman Pontiff. As Pope, Paul finished the work of the Second Vatican Council and then devoted the next years to the colossal task of implementing its many reforms in the middle of immense social and political upheaval and during the storm of the sexual revolution.
Certainly, this was the encyclical that made Paul VI suffer the most. I believe that one of the difficulties in the drafting of this document, now that we have clearer information about it, thanks to the opening of the archives, was that he was reaffirming the teaching of the Church and openness to life. But, and at the same time, he was enhancing the family context in human and anthropological terms. Already in 1968, when the encyclical came out, he understood that this context of openness to human life needed to be defended from the theological invasion that ultimately takes away the value and human dimension from the act of procreation.
All of those warnings have come true, just like his predictions that the modern world would be plagued by atheism, secularism, and materialism. He had taken the name Paul to embody his desire to be a pilgrim to all nations, and his papacy was noted for its then unprecedented travels. In 1965, he became the first pope to visit the United States. In a famous speech before the United Nations General Assembly in New York, he called on the world, "No more war. War never again." Throughout his last years, he defended the true teachings of the Council and the Church's teachings on human sexuality, marriage, and human dignity. The Pope was saddened by the rejection of Humanae Vitae by so many Catholics and even priests and theologians, and he prophetically warned the world about the future consequences of a contraceptive culture. Pope Paul VI died at Castel Gandolfo on August the 6th, 1978. Pope, priest, and prophet, the teachings of Pope Paul VI have echoed across the pontificates of his successors, John Paul I, St. John Paul II, Benedict XVI, and Francis. The National Eucharistic Congress is a significant event in the three-year revival initiated by the U.S. bishops to restore faith in the Eucharist among Catholics in the country. The Congress aims to bring together the entire Church in the United States with the goal of igniting the participants' faith, enabling them to become missionaries in their own communities.
How was that? Can you tell us a little bit more about this encounter?
Andreas Thonhauser, EWTN Vatican Bureau Chief, sat down with Bishop Andrew Cousins, Bishop of the Diocese of Crookston, to discuss the upcoming National Eucharistic Congress in the United States.
Bishop Andrew Cousins, you have just met the Holy Father blessing the monstrance for the National Eucharistic Congress, which will take place next year in the U.S. How was that? Can you tell us a little bit more about this encounter?
It was a very emotional experience for all of us. We had all the organizers of the Congress there. He just received us all so warmly, and you felt his emotion and his passion and his excitement for this National Eucharistic Congress. He spoke about it so beautifully. So, and especially, he's just out of the hospital, right? So for him to come and give us this address and to meet with us personally and to greet each of us personally, it was very, very moving.
Can you tell us a little bit more about this Congress? It's the 10th National Eucharistic Congress, but what I understand, it's really something new as well.
Yes, so the Congress is really the high point of the National Eucharistic Revival, which the U.S. bishops started as a pastoral evangelistic initiative to try to restore faith in the Eucharist throughout the Catholics of our country, because we know it's at an all-time low, right? And so the bishops have organized this three-year revival, and at its center is this National Eucharistic Congress, where we hope to gather the whole Church in the United States.
And can you share a little bit, what did the Holy Father say about adoration, about the Eucharist?
Yeah, the Holy Father gave us a beautiful address about the centrality of the Eucharist. And really, he made kind of three special points where he went off script. The first was when he talked about adoration, and he said, we've lost the sense of adoration in our culture today, and we need to teach people how to do adoration, especially adoration in silence, which is something we've been trying to do as part of the revival. The second thing he mentioned when he went off script was about the importance of going out. So how important it is to come to Mass, to receive Jesus, to do adoration. But then we have to take Jesus out to the world. And that's really the missionary impulse. And we know the church in the United States needs to make that missionary conversion. We need to become missionaries. And the third thing he said was not to forget the poor. And he mentioned in particular the elderly and the sick. He said, when you go out to find them, you find Jesus.
There have been surveys in the U.S., but also in other places in the world, that Catholics who claim to be Catholics say they no longer believe really in the real presence in the Eucharist.
You know, what I see is this is kind of the result of secularization in our country that we've seen in the United States and in other countries, right? And adopting a kind of completely secular mindset that allows us to seek happiness simply in the things of this world, which will never make us happy, right? And that secularization has led many people away from even that first commandment of honoring God above all things, which is what Sunday Mass is, right? The third commandment helps us keep the first commandment of honoring God above all things. And so we've seen that. We've also seen a kind of change in the worldview of the people in our world and in our time. And so people have a very kind of scientistic worldview. Of course, science is important and it teaches us about reality, but it doesn't tell us everything about reality. It doesn't tell us who created everything. And when the Bible talks about reality, it says the world is telling the glory of God. The whole world is a sacrament. Everything that exists points to the reason that it exists. And we've lost that sense. And so it's difficult for people to understand, how could this piece of bread actually be God? You might remember, though, when Notre Dame Cathedral burned in Paris, the Archbishop of Notre Dame, he said, we didn't build this beautiful cathedral for the crown of thorns or to contain beautiful works of art. We built this beautiful cathedral because we believe a piece of bread becomes God, and we built it for God, right?
What will the Congress do in order to help faithful also maybe rediscover the real presence in the Eucharist?
Yeah, the Congress is really the center point of a movement of the Eucharistic revival where we're doing all kinds of things. So we had Eucharistic congresses, Eucharistic processions, all kinds of teaching on the Eucharist this whole last year, more than we've ever had in the United States. And then this parish year, we're going to have small groups in as many parishes as we can studying the Eucharist. We're going to increase Eucharistic devotion in those parishes, right? Inviting them to have a Eucharistic culture. And really to reach those people who maybe they do come to Mass sometimes, but they don't really understand Jesus in the Eucharist, right? And then the Congress will be this moment of unity where we all come together, where we're inspired by the best of Catholic speakers who will all be there, where we have these moments of beautiful prayer and Mass together, where we experience that revival, that word which means to bring back to life, right? To set on fire.
Bishop Andrew Cousins, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you so much. And we've been so proud to have EWTN as a partner in this work of the Eucharistic Congress from the beginning. So thank you.
Thank you.
We'll be back after a short break with more on Vaticano.
Universal challenges call for universal answers.
On Monday, May the 29th, a concert at the Papal Basilica of St. Paul outside the walls was held to commemorate the 200 years since the fire and reconstruction of the basilica. It was on the night of July the 15th, 1823, when a fire erupted from the wooden ceiling of the Papal Basilica, reducing the 4th century building, second in size only to St. Peter's Basilica, to a heap of smoking beams and piles of rubble. It was a shock for Romans and the entire Christian community. The new basilica was rebuilt and consecrated on December the 10th, 1854. The concert held to commemorate the reconstruction was entitled Religioni Unite, or United Religions in Music, with the Jerusalem Symphony Orchestra, conducted by Yeruham Skarovsky, and young solo cellist Daniel Acta. Interreligious dialogue and 30 years of diplomatic relations between the State of Israel and the Holy See were also celebrated during the event.
I would say that we were looking with this double motive to maybe have a symbolic act of culture to show a kind of harmony or unification or interface dialogue between the Abrahamic Accords. And this is also why in the program of this evening you will hear compositions by composers of the three religions, a Christian one, a Jewish one, and a Muslim one. And we thought that taking this opportunity of the 200 years on one hand and 30 years on the other hand is also in a way, let's say, to combine old and new. I mean, 200 years is by now a time that has passed, while relations between Israel and the Holy See are still young.
The musical pieces performed covered a wide range from Bach to Schubert, from Bruch to Elkater. The program opened with the famous Bach choral, Jesus bleibet meine Freude, and Schubert's Ave Maria. There was also a tribute to Italy with Symphony No. 4 in A major, known as the Italian Symphony, written by Felix Mendelssohn Bartholdy during his stay in Italy in 1830. He was attracted to the traditions and folk songs, nature and folklore.
This is, of course, all very symbolic, and again, the dialogue, the tacit dialogue maybe between Rome and Jerusalem, two cities, two iconic cities with their history and tradition, is all the time, I wouldn't say in the background, it's very present, and it's great to have it and to have it as part of what we are doing here this evening.
Music and the arts were once again on display to lay the foundations for peace and respect between different faiths and to shine a light on the important role Rome and Jerusalem play on the international stage.